Welcome to the first Mostly Microbes podcast. Today's guest is Dr. Alice Callahan. She is the blogger behind the very popular evidence-based blog, Science of Mom, and she has a new book out with the same name, where she discusses so many different aspects to new infant care and that first year that is so fine for so many of us. I hope you enjoy it. Can you start by telling me why you wrote this book?
So parenting is really tough these days. I think because we have access to so much information on the internet, books and other people's opinions, we get lots of conflicting and inaccurate information in that mix. And I think science is a really helpful tool that can help us sort through that. And maybe it's under-recognized or not understood as well as we'd like by parents. So I think it's really helpful to present this information just from a very evidence-based perspective, including discussion of where science doesn't have all the answers. And I think in that way, you sort of get these case studies for how to look at questions and how to sort through science and figure out what's really useful and what's not as useful. So that was sort of my goal with the book. And then the more personal and selfish reason was just that I think this stuff is really fascinating. And so it was fun for me as a parent and someone with a science background to spend a lot of time reading and writing about science.
Oh, that's awesome. So what was your favorite finding?
I thought it was really interesting to look at some things that are pretty specific, like cutting of the umbilical cord and the vitamin K shot. Those two in particular, I think, have really interesting histories behind them. I really like trying to understand the history of a practice and cultural influences on it. I guess like sleep safety would also kind of fit into that category. You know, there's interesting history and cultural aspects to it. And then tying that in with our sort of most recent research, I thought was really interesting. And I learned a lot about all of those topics too, through the research.
I really liked that you did include several different cultures and have an international perspective in your book in a lot of instances. And I really liked that and appreciated that. So often it feels like books are written more for just a U.S. audience. I like talked about what other cultures do.
Yeah, and I think that's really valuable perspective too, because it's important to recognize when our science is really biased. You know, our science on infant sleep that's conducted here in the U.S. is really focused on understanding how babies sleep when they're sleeping alone in a crib. And and then when you do the same studies on an infant that's sleeping with its mother, the physiology of that's really different. So I think that's really neat and just important to recognize. And it doesn't mean that one way is right or wrong, but just that it does influence the scientific findings. So as parents, to not get so tied to doing things, you know, a certain way, because we're all influenced by so many different factors that determine what makes sense to us. And, you know, that's okay.
Exactly. Another thing I really liked was that you talked a lot about scientific consensus and how that relates to parenting choices. Can you describe what a scientific consensus is and kind of how it does relate to these different choices? And also when you thought a particular topic actually had reached that scientific consensus?
Yeah, I think that's a really important thing to be aware of when you're a parent, you know, trying to assess scientific evidence. The way I describe consensus in my book is if you took 100 scientists and put them in a room and asked them a question, if 90 to 95 of them all wholeheartedly agreed on that question, you can be pretty certain that there's consensus there. And if there was a much bigger split in opinions in the room, then you know that probably that area hasn't reached consensus among scientists. You know, the people that study that topic, if there's disagreement, then that tells us that probably the research is still evolving and there's a lot more that we need to know. So I think being aware of where there's consensus, means that that's an area we can have pretty good confidence in as parents, that you're taking that science and allowing it to help us make those decisions. That's what you really want as a parent. You want to be able to find that consensus and feel confident in your choices, right? And that also insulates you from misinformation, which could come from single studies. For example, the vitamin K shot, there's really strong scientific consensus around the world that single intramuscular shot of vitamin K at birth is really protective of newborns and is incredibly safe. You know, there's this one study that showed an association between childhood cancer and the vitamin K shot. One study that's raised alarms about the vitamin K shot Lots of scientists followed that study with more studies, and I think there were something like 12 studies that came after that that showed no association. So, that was an example where there was a correlation that was identified, but when scientists followed that up, they weren't able to identify that as a real relationship. And so now, again, the consensus is the shot's incredibly safe. But you'll definitely find on the internet websites that list that cancer myth as a problem with the shot and cite this study. So if you're not looking for consensus, then you could easily be misled there. So it's important to look at all the studies on that topic and try to see where the consensus lies. And so I think looking for consensus can sort of insulate you from falling into those kind of misinformation traps that might be based on a single study.
Along those lines, you were talking about the different social influences of the studies with sleep and how in the U.S. that's where most of the sleep studies are done, and they're done in babies who are in cribs. So in that case, I guess you need to make sure that the data you're looking at too are not from just one part of the world and one type of study too, right? Because you could still have consensus of the U.S. positions on information about sleep, but then if you look across.
But I do think anytime you're looking at the scientific evidence, you do want to check to make sure that the studies are on populations that are similar to your own. So that's a question that's worth asking. And in a lot of cases, like vitamin K, again, as an example, or vaccines, we have studies from all around the world, and really strong international consensus on those issues. Safety of co-sleeping or actually bed sharing is a controversial issue, and it is controversial among scientists. So some people would say we have consensus on that here in the US, and I'm not sure if that's really true. We have scientists that disagree with whether or not bed sharing with infants is safe, because the studies aren't perfect in that area, and there are lots of confounding factors, and there are cultural influences on sleep safety here in the U.S. that make it hard to decipher whether or not that's actually co-sleeping, that's the risk, or all the other factors that occur around co-sleeping. So, I think you make a good point that it's not always cut and dry to say, like, this is a question we feel really certain about and have strong consensus on, but.
So along those lines, as you well know, I'm very excited about the microbiome, and I noticed you didn't get into much detail about the role of the microbiome in birth or feeding. Could you talk about that decision? Is that more of a consensus issue? Just so many things to talk about, covered so much great stuff as it was.
Yeah, I'm sorry to disappoint you.
No, that's good. At least opening for my book.
Yeah, exactly. Right. I mean, when you mention it, I think like there probably was room to go into more of that. And at one point, I thought about a chapter on the microbiome. I thought about chapters on a few things that I just didn't get to. Like my deadline was coming, and I just had to figure out what I was going to include and what I was not going to include. But certainly there's really interesting stuff on feeding and the microbiome. But I do think that that science, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, or you might have a different take on it because it's definitely not my field of expertise. But I think that science is still so new that as far as like taking the research and making really useful recommendations to parents, about I don't think we really know yet how to optimize our microbiomes or what it, what that looks like. We know that it matters, but how much it matters and how much our personal decisions affect it, I think it's kind of tough to say. So that's part of the reason why I didn't go into it as much. Even though I think lots of parents would be interested in knowing more about it, and it's certainly a hot topic right now. And then again, there's interesting things about the microbiome in birth, but that was sort of outside of the scope of my book. And originally I did want to include more about childbirth, and that was another place where I had to draw the line and say, I'm starting with cutting of the cord. So,
yeah, I thought that was a really interesting place to start, actually, where you have that first transition stage. So, yeah, and I think you're right that it is too early to make a lot of changes. There are some things that, as long as they already line up with, standard advice from reputable sources, like, increasing fruits and vegetables and whole grains helps your microbiome. Well, that's what people have been saying for quite some time. So that
yeah.
I was really interested in your research
for your PhD and also your postdoc and your thoughts on first food, given that background. But one of the things I always have wondered about is the importance of gut development and actually the epithelial lining of the gut coming together and mm-hmm. that timing of introduction of solid food.
Mm-hmm.
Do you look at any of that researching parts of the book?
That's a really interesting area where I feel like there's sort of this common understanding of gut development in infants and the effects of the ways that we feed them on gut development. I mean, you hear this idea of virgin gut thrown around a lot when you introduce complementary foods or formula, you're ruining the virgin gut. But there's not very much science to support that idea. And that's something I'd like to write a blog post on because I think there are a lot of misconceptions on the internet about that. And it's actually hard to find information about it when you're looking at the academic literature.
Yeah.
So definitely first few months of life, there's a lot of gut development happening. There's development of the epithelium and there is decreased gut permeability during that time. And there's a lot of work on that on mature infants because it's so important to them to have, you know, that they have good gut development after birth. So there's some truth to that idea, but you know, what we know based on looking at outcomes in infants and the things, the important outcomes that we're really concerned with are things like the risk of food allergies or autoimmune diseases. And what we're seeing more and more is that it seems like there is this sort of sweet spot when you want to be exposing the gut to these different food proteins. And it seems to be between about 4 and 6 months. You know, I think the studies kind of vary on that. And if you're introducing at 7 months, I think that's probably fine too. But it's maybe a little bit earlier than we thought before.
That's interesting.
Yeah, so the way it's explained in the research is that, you know, before about 4 months, the gut is still very immature and the immune system is immature. And a lot of that maturation is happening in concert with the development of the gut microbiome. And beyond about 6, 7, 8 months, it's matured to the extent that you don't get oral tolerance of these food proteins and the risk of food allergies is increased. And the risk, and then the autoimmune diseases like celiac and type 1 diabetes also seem to show a similar pattern. So there seems to be this place where the gut development and immune development is not totally mature, but that's actually the right time to sort of educate the immune system about these proteins that are part of our lives. And we want to be able to handle them when we encounter them in our bodies. That's sort of what the data are saying right now. I wouldn't say that there's consensus on this issue, but definitely like avoiding common food allergens seems to only increase the risk of food allergies. So it does seem like introducing those allergens in infancy is important. And there is this sort of window during development when maybe things are still a little bit immature, but that actually seems to be the right time to introduce.
It would be interesting to combine that with the microbiome studies as well and see if you have different thresholds for when the gut is developing, is maturing at different rates, depending on what the microbiome is. I know with a lot of the fruit fly work that I used to do, some studies were done where they were showing that if you radiate the gut of the fruit fly, it completely destroys the gut. But if you give them probiotic bacteria, just reintroduce some of the bacteria you could culture from the gut, then it can repair itself faster from radiation damage. So,
Well, there was a neat study that came out earlier this year from UNC. I think the first author is Thompson. I don't know if you saw that one, that where they looked at shifts in the microbiome of infants with the introduction of solid foods, and they compared exclusively breastfed to formula-fed infants.
Yeah.
And was really neat. They actually showed that exclusive breastfeeding seemed to sort of buffer the infant from these really big shifts in the microbiome, right? So I thought that was neat too. I mean, I think again, with every baby, there's all these factors that are interacting.
Right.
But, you know, I sort of think, or I used to think of introducing solid foods as just being this huge dramatic change for the baby. And it is, but they're also, you know, they're encountering lots of things in their environment and as well as from foods. And I think that healthy microbiome is important to helping them with that transition. And I also, another thing that I think is important about the timing of solid foods is to recognize that, you know, when we look at other cultures, at ethnographic reports of pre-industrial societies, earlier introduction of solid foods is actually really common. Several papers that I've seen, it's like 50% to two-thirds commonly did introduce solid foods before 6 months, and some of them much earlier than that.
Oh, wow.
There's also really interesting papers on the role of pre-mastication or pre-chewing foods for infants.
Yeah, and that's some of your microbiome too.
Yeah, exactly. So that's contributing to microbiome, and it's also making foods accessible to young infants.
Right.
I think humans are really flexible. When you look at practices around the world, it's not unusual to be introducing babies to some of these foods when they're pretty young. And whether or not that's right or wrong, I think, you know, We're still working on figuring that out. It's just an important thing to consider, I think, when we're questioning our assumptions about it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. More to lifestyle. So how does your scientific knowledge or your research interest influence your living habits? You know, have you changed your practices because of all your scientific knowledge?
I would say that actually all of this science hasn't changed the way I do things too much. I can start by saying that, you know, my strongest background is in nutrition, and that's the field of my PhD. And actually, I'll tell you that my postdoc, which is in fetal physiology, I was studying gestational diabetes and the effects of, you know, increased sugar exposure on the fetus carried by diabetic moms. So that's what I was studying when I was pregnant with my daughter. Didn't have gestational diabetes, which is good because I would have had a lot of anxiety about that. But that spurred a lot of things for me about environmental influences on the fetus. And it just kind of inspired me to read a lot of science. It didn't necessarily change how I did things too much, but that was sort of the beginning of me getting interested in science as a parent. From a nutrition standpoint, sometimes people are surprised when I say that, you know, I have a lot of training in nutrition, but I'm actually really laid back about eating. And what I know about nutrition, definitely I do pay a lot of attention to the way we eat. And we do, you know, eat, I think, really balanced meals and focus mostly on whole foods. But I also think that a really important part of raising kids in today's food environment is teaching them how to cook, and teaching them that the rituals around food, coming together and sharing meals together, that's really important. And having really healthy attitudes about food are really important. So it's funny that, you know, I have a lot of training on biochemistry of nutrient digestion and absorption and breakdown. And I think when it comes to applying what I know about nutrition in real life, I think sometimes the rituals around cooking and eating are more important than the actual food. You know, not much else about my research on parenting has really changed the way I do things. In a lot of ways, it's helped me to be more relaxed, and sleep is an area where that's really helped. Like, understanding what normal sleep development looks like really helpful to me. Even today with a 9-month-old, you know, their sleep is always changing, and sometimes I find myself getting a little anxious about not sleeping as well as his sister did, or I wish that things were falling into place a little bit faster. And I know from doing the research on sleep that his sleep is totally normal. And
I can relate.
So that's been really helpful, and sort of recognition of the different ways that people do it around the world, I think, is also helpful, just to sort of feel comfortable figuring out what works in our family. But I think overall, the understanding of the science has been really important to my confidence as a parent. Yeah. So I'm much less likely to get sucked into internet forums or question my decisions as much. And that's been really helpful for sure. Yeah.
I found the same thing. Kind of nice sometimes to go to the literature and go, okay, it's really all right.
Right.
Has there been an aspect of your life then that has influenced your scientific interests, either before having kids or after having kids? I don't know where you are on your trajectory, but.
Well, yeah, definitely. I mean, my transition to becoming a mom inspired me to start my blog and write the book. So definitely that personal experience of becoming a mom and having all of these questions about parenting inspired me to dig into a lot of science. And, you know, the other area that I'm thinking about writing more about is miscarriage and infertility, because that was another thing that I was experiencing when I was working on this book. And I didn't, at that time, didn't have a lot of time to write about it, but I was definitely looking into the science on it. And I think that's another area where science can be really helpful for helping us to understand why something like a miscarriage happens and how often it happens and what the possible causes are and what the prognosis is. I think people really need more information about that, and science could be really helpful with sort of normalizing that experience and helping couples who are experiencing miscarriage still feel confident about the future. The things that, the interests that have developed since becoming a parent and doing this writing, I think would change the type of research that I did if I ever went back to that world. So I probably would be much more interested in focusing on infant nutrition or maternal nutrition. But
oh. Well, thanks so much for taking time to chat with me. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate your interest in the book. It's been really fun to interact with you about it.